This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and happy Friday. My name is Jordan Fennell and you're with me here on Pacific Beat this morning. Today on the show, some of New Zealand's top Indigenous academics have written a letter to the University of Waikato with allegations of racism. And it sparked a massive discussion on social media about how deep it runs.
I just thought, if I don't speak out, if I don't say anything, as far as I'm concerned, another two generations of Māori are going to have to live with the consequences.
Coming up in the show, you'll hear from Dr. Linda Tuiwai-Smith, who is known as the mother of Indigenous studies, about what that letter said and what has been done about it. And the push for a Pacific Islands team to join a revamped Super Rugby Aotearoa competition next year is gaining momentum.
Between us, we're in the top 8 teams in the world. But when rugby union went professional, nobody cared about us, left us out of the loop. And so it's been a long time waiting, long overdue.
Coming up in around half an hour, you'll hear from Colden Kamea, the man who introduced rugby league to Fiji in the early 1990s, about his bid for a Fiji-based Pacific team. But first, the names of PNG politicians have been found on a Chinese database.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
A Chinese company with links to Beijing's military and intelligence networks has been amassing a vast database of personal information on millions of people from around the world, including prominent and influential figures. Among the names, there are several hundred from the Pacific. Numerous Papua New Guinean politicians, their family members, bureaucrats and church leaders are on the database. And our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting has been going through the list and she joins me now. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning, Jordan.
Firstly, Natalie, what can you tell us about this database?
Well, as you briefly mentioned there, it's being pulled together by a Chinese company. They're from the Shenzhen area called Zhenhua Data. Now, we know that this company does have links to Beijing's military and intelligence network. So this is raising concerns that it's part of a rather broad surveillance type program. Now, this database has been leaked to the media, both in Australia and elsewhere in the world. And there's 2.4 million people whose names are in this database that's been leaked, including more than 35,000 Australians. So people may have heard some coverage of some of the Australian names on the list. So the information is scraped from the internet, as they say. So it's a compile of people's social media profiles, news articles, things that are online, and it's been sort of drawn together. And we have seen high-profile names on there from people across the world, business leaders, industry, politics. As I say, it's taken from across the globe and hundreds from the Pacific amongst them.
And who are some of those high-profile names on the list?
Well, if we look at PNG, we've got a mix of politicians, both past and some present. There are judges, current and former ambassadors, several high-profile police officers and former police officers, and ministers. So, you know, the Treasurer, Ian Ling Stuckey, the Communications Minister, the State Enterprise Operations Minister, they're all on this list, along with some church leaders, some bishops, and quite a few bougainvillians. Obviously, we've seen Bougainville going through a referendum process seeking independence in their own country. So one of the people on the list from Bougainville is the outgoing Deputy Speaker, Francesca Somoso. Obviously, she's currently seeking re-election, and she said that you know, it is a high-profile time for Bougainville because of the referendum and everything that's been going on in the region. But she was quite concerned about her name being on this list, and she didn't quite understand what the interest would be in her specifically. Here's a little of what she had to say.
If I am monitored, I don't know for what reason, but maybe because I'm a leader and I'm a woman as well, and for me to be monitored and, you know, and stuff like that, I'm angry. It's like, ooh, why would you want to do that?
And Nat, were there any surprises on this database?
Well, it's interesting. It's not comprehensive. You know, we have some high-profile politicians, but also some high-profile people who aren't on there. For instance, PNG's Prime Minister James Morape, he's not on the list, despite his long career in politics. So, as I say, it is a bit of a strange mix. You know, there are some politicians on there who have died, and there are politicians from vastly different eras. And it's also, you know, there's some people on there who appear to be on there purely for the fact that they've committed some kind of crime. So there's a few criminals on there, people involved in robberies or financial crimes. And the other interesting thing is for some politicians and former ambassadors, their names aren't on there, but family members are. For instance, former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, his name isn't on there, but two of his relatives are. And also interesting to note that there doesn't seem to be as much information compiled on some of the PNG names as what we've seen with people from other countries. So for a lot of it, it's just their name and perhaps a couple of links to articles. It doesn't, from what has been leaked, there's not as big a profile that appears to have been built. But, you know, it is an interesting sign of the sort of surveillance that is possible in this online era, and, you know, the amount of information that can be gained online and can be brought together in such a comprehensive way.
Yeah, very interesting, and something that we'll keep our eye on if there's any more developments. Natalie, thank you so much for bringing us that news this morning.
Thanks, Jordan.
That was our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting, speaking there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. It's been quiet again on the COVID-19 front in Papua New Guinea over the last 24 hours. There were no fresh announcements from the Office of the National Pandemic Controller, David Manning. And in fact, that has been the case all week. The relative calm has allowed attention to switch to Mr. Manning himself, with some critics claiming that PNG's already busy police commissioner shouldn't be heading up the National Pandemic Centre at all. As Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, the country's police force has been marred by controversy over officer behaviour, and it's chronically underfunded, with a recent report concluding that it will take around $1.5 billion to put all existing problems right.
Papua New Guinea police personnel already work in some of the toughest conditions in the world, with a lack of simple resources including uniforms and vehicles. Much of the housing that's provided for police officers is deteriorating. And now, the force is not just responsible for maintaining law and order, it's also in charge of implementing the country's COVID-19 rules. Under the PNG National Pandemic Act, which was passed in June, the country's top cop, David Manning, is in charge of the National Pandemic Centre, the nerve centre of the government's COVID-19 response, adding more responsibilities to his already large and challenging workload.
I think you have to give David Manning a lot of credit for juggling both roles. There's been a lot going on. The pandemic is obviously a huge issue day to day. Lots of things to manage, from the restrictions to enforcing them.
Shane McLeod, a PNG researcher with the Australian think tank Lowy Institute, says having the police commissioner in front appears to be working.
Any orders or any requirements that are issued have the weight of the police commissioner behind them, so that if there needs to be enforcement, then it's very clear who's going to be enforcing it.
But apart from dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, the day-to-day job of the police commissioner has had to go on, including some very high-profile cases, such as PNG's biggest drug bust when a plane crashed outside the capital in July with more than 500 kilograms of cocaine on board that police allege was being smuggled to Australia. There are daily reports of violence in the Highlands region, as well as the towns of Medang, Port Moresby and Lae. It led the former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill to raise the matter in Parliament recently. He suggests the police commissioner should stick to one job.
Every day there is murder taking place, innocent lives lost at the hands of warlords and criminals who are terrorizing our communities. This is happening right across the country, in places like Medan, Pogora, Lae, Port Moresby. It is becoming a daily event that someone or some number of people, Papua New Guinean, young, innocent people, are dying every day.
Mr. O'Neill criticised the government, accusing it of neglecting law and order as it focused on managing the pandemic.
You are spending hundreds of millions of kina on COVID after only 4 deaths. Are you going to show the commitment that you are showing to COVID to the murders that are taking place in our country? Mr. Speaker, as we speak today, your police minister and your police commissioner are very much focused on arresting COVID-19.
Money is a sticking point for PNG's police force. A recent report funded by the Australian government through its PNG Australia Policing Partnership concluded that the PNG police force is underfunded. It suggests that a one-off cost of 3.9 billion kina, that's around 1.5 billion Australian dollars, is needed to fix its existing problems, such as a lack of resources, training and infrastructure. It found that PNG faces a severe lack of officers at a ratio of one police officer to every 1,145 people, while the level that's recommended by the United Nations is one police officer to 450 people. The report acknowledged the PNG government doesn't have the means to cover the costs required and so recommends it considers getting grants and highly concessional loans from partners. It also suggested staff-provided accommodation could be replaced with staff housing allowances, and it also said the recruitment process should be redesigned. Prime Minister James Marape blames former governments for the current state of the police force.
Governments of past, including his government under his leadership, failed to heed to the cry of not only Hell and South Netherlands but resource provinces to ensure that this police station and police structures get approved and looked at.
The country's police minister, Brian Cremer, is also aware of the challenges they now face. He took to social media for his independence message, writing that the police department is in complete disarray after years of rapid corruption. But he says the government is addressing the issues front on, writing, "Under the Marape-Stephen government, we have taken the first steps to implement sweeping reform." He said that, "Today, the police force and law and order has become the center point of national discussion, and that's exactly where it needs to be." He went on to say, "The police force is now getting the attention it so desperately needs. The ABC has contacted the minister and the police commissioner for comment. And there's no suggestion the government plans to act on the criticism of Peter O'Neill and either replace David Manning as police commissioner or remove him from his role as head of the COVID-19 response." And Shane McLeod from the Lowy Institute, who also spent years working in PNG as the ABC's correspondent, supports that.
So as long as he continues to get the support from, I guess, both the health officials and also the police officials, then he's able to juggle both requirements. And for now, he has been that very prominent face of the pandemic response. I'm not sure what would really be gained by taking him away from that role at this point.
That's the Lowy Institute's Shane McLeod ending that report from Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
Let's have some music now to ease us into this Friday morning. This one is from a Maori soul singer out of New Zealand. He goes by the name Teeks, and this is his song, If Only.
If only I could love you like you want me to, then everything would be alright. And if only it was that easy, if only it was that simple, if only I could click my fingers. My finger.
Maori soul singer Teex with his song If Only.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Allegations of racism have been put to New Zealand's Ministry of Education and the University of Waikato through a letter written by prominent Indigenous academics. They claim that university staff were not being given protections under the Treaty of Waitangi, which is the founding document of the country and an agreement between Maori chiefs and the British signed back in the 1800s. One of the writers was Dr. Linda Tuiwai-Smith, whose contract as Professor of Maori and Indigenous Studies was not renewed by the university. I spoke with Dr. Tuiwai-Smith to find out more.
We argued that the Crown was failing to protect us as Maori staff under the Treaty of Waitangi. You know, we're pointing to basically the way decisions are made, the way resources are allocated, and the actual lived experiences of Māori staff and students inside the institution. And, you know, that really is the tip of an iceberg. There's no nice, polite way to serve it up on a platter. You know, these are messy issues and they're painful. And, you know, many of our colleagues have been traumatised by experiences that I've had in the university.
And what happened after you sent that letter to the Crown? What sort of response did you get back immediately?
Nothing much, you know, a kind of thank you for your letter type response, and then a sort of more thoughtful response later. And it's still there with the Ministry of Education. But in the meantime, you know, we also sent a copy of that letter to the Chancellor of the University. And the response there was firstly silent and was a non-response. And then it kind of blew up. So the university has implemented a review.
And when you say it blew up, you took your letter and the information you had to the media, where it's gained a lot of traction, and especially on social media, where other Indigenous academics have become really vocal about this issue as well. How have you felt about that response from your peers?
I'm just, like, overwhelmed. You know, I have a Twitter account. I don't actually know how to use it. And then I've had friends, like, taking screenshots and sending them to me, and other people reading things out. It's overwhelming. It's enormously humbling. We absolutely appreciate the support. My focus is really on getting the university to accept there is a problem around systemic racism and to commit to addressing it.
And on that, as you said, the university has now committed to doing a review. They've commissioned an independent review that will make recommendations to improve the uni's policies and practices. Is that the response you were after?
That is the response they've brought in. We did want an independent set of eyes. And so they did bring in two, I guess, high-profile Māori people, one a former Minister of Education and one a very well-known Māori leader as well. And we were given a week. In fact, the staff and students were given a week to give submissions. And I'm really proud of our colleagues and students, actually, because they rose to the challenge. And in 1 week, apparently there are hundreds of submissions. So we are now waiting for what that review might say. So definitely we thought it was appropriate that the Chancellor and Council grapple with these issues.
The issue of systemic racism that you've highlighted has been towards the University of Waikato specifically, but as someone who works closely with Indigenous academics and students, are they facing similar issues across the rest of New Zealand, but also here in Australia?
Well, you know, I do think actually Australian universities have really catapulted forward even beyond where New Zealand universities have gone in relation to recognition of Indigenous development and advancement. But it's uneven. It's not a management you know, cynical marketing ploy. Universities are complex institutions with multiple institutions of knowledge inside them. So changing universities is notoriously difficult. And I think in order to address systemic racism, it's the same as sexism as well, is you do have to dive deep into the bowels of the institution, into its veins, into its bones, in terms of what has to be addressed, because it's every part of it. So it's no use just having a grand plan that we're going to do this, but, you know, how are institutions held to account? And in New Zealand, we do see that is really important, that in terms of the Treaty of Waitangi, that it's not only in our documents, but that it also means something.
And you've been with the university for 12 years, but I saw that it was reported that your contract was not renewed, you know, after these sort of events transpired, and you, supporters on social media were saying that you were pushed out of your job for bringing up these allegations. Is this the case?
No, and, you know, I have responded to that, but I can understand why that issue sort of galvanised people, but I always knew my contract was up for negotiations anyway at this time of the year. It's just timing. So that was, a coincidence.
And so as you move on then from the University of Waikato, what do you hope to see come from all of this?
You know, if there's one institution that could actually address this issue, is the University of Waikato. It requires them to be bold and brave. Racism can destroy people's studies and can destroy careers. I think it's important, though, that, you know, our students don't get distracted by this. It's not their job to fight it. I was kind of smiling at the energy that many of them put into their submissions, and I was sending the messages saying, wow, be really good if you put some energy into the chapter of your thesis and to your assignment that's due this weekend. But, I'm proud of them. You know, I do know some of the stories that students have told about their own experiences, particularly with casual racism. But I would rather fight that battle for them. I just thought, if I don't speak out, if I don't say anything, as far as I'm concerned, another two generations of Māori are going to have to live with the consequences of this, and the time has come to deal with systemic racism. It should not be in our institutions, and it goes for Australia as well.
That was Dr. Linda Tuiwai-Smith speaking with me there, and the preliminary findings from that review are meant to be presented today, and we'll keep you updated here on ABC Radio Australia on any developments. Now it's time to find out all the latest weather news from across the region. And I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, for that. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, good morning.
How is it looking out there today?
Yeah, it's still pretty good around the South Pacific. There's quite a bit of activity around the Solomons. There's some scattered thunderstorms around the islands. Nothing very organised, but enough to make life a bit uncomfortable, but certainly helpful for the farmers. But elsewhere, fine weather. High pressure that was near New Zealand over the last few days is actually now funneling off to the east, but there's a frontal system passing across the North Island right now. But by the end of today, a new high will push off the east-southeast corner of the Australian continent into the Tasman Sea and effectively replace the one that's gone, and we won't see any appreciable change. So trade winds still dominating, generally settled weather, mostly sunny over most places. Some sneaky showers about the windward coasts of the larger islands around the region. That includes Port Vila and also Suva and Fiji, and possibly also in Nuku'alofa. But for the most part, most islands will enjoy a sunny day.
And looking ahead just to the weekend, what can we expect there across the region?
So a pretty good weekend across our part of the world. There's still a number of scattered thunderstorms dotted around the Micronesian Islands to the north. We were looking at the potential for a system to develop yesterday, but that wave in the trade winds has now moved over the islands of the Philippine Islands and has weakened now. So There is a typhoon in the South China Sea approaching the coast of Vietnam. That's one of seven active tropical systems, which kind of ties our all-time record. And one of those systems is actually called a Medicane. It's actually a hurricane in the Mediterranean Sea. So we've got them in all corners of the world right now, and fortunately, though, in the Pacific, it stays fairly quiet for us.
I feel like I haven't heard about a hurricane over the Mediterranean Sea. Is that rare?
See them. You might see one every year or two. This one that we have right now is a particularly spectacular one. It's got a clear eye, and it's affecting, obviously, in the Mediterranean Sea, generally not too far from any of the land area. So it is going to be a bit of a nuisance for a number of countries, particularly in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, off North Africa and around Greek Island and southern Italy. So some nasty weather there for them. And there's a couple now still threatening the US. And one, obviously, as I mentioned, affecting Vietnam. So, and one also off the coast of Spain. It's actually in the far northeast Atlantic. And might move up and weaken, but affect parts of Western Europe over the coming weekend.
So some very interesting weather news happening just across the globe. But thank you, Neville, for bringing us those updates on our region here.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandreki Weather, bringing us those weather updates from around the world.
Foreman, hold the front page!
Now it's time to find out all the latest news just from across the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So it's been all quiet, as we heard, on the COVID front in Papua New Guinea, with not a single new case reported since Monday. And that should be good news, but it comes amid continuing doubts about the true picture of PNG.
It does. The bare facts, I guess, are good news for sure. If the numbers are not going up, that has to be good, doesn't it? But concerns continue to be raised about low testing rates and the fact that many of the 500 or so confirmed cases in PNG have been described as asymptomatic. So that just confuses the picture a little more. Here's the director of Papua New Guinea's Institute of Medical Research, Dr. William Pomat.
We might be seeing the end of the, or at least the plateauing of a pandemic. But on the other hand, I think since we haven't done enough testing, this could be more a reflection of people, not enough people coming in for testing if they have symptoms, or if they're just coming for testing to check themselves. So I believe that maybe the second indicator of people not turning up for testing might be the reason why we're not seeing that many cases.
Now, right now, there are just a handful of testing centres operating around the country, and Dr. Pomat estimates that it would need tests on at least 1% of the population in each province to get an accurate picture. And he says PNG is seeking help from Australia and other international donors to speed up the results of those tests that are being carried out.
One of the things that we've asked for is to help us to be able to have the results turn around quickly. So our partners, CFAT in particular, and World Bank as well, are going to be helping us to obtain what they call an automated extraction machine, because extracting the DNA from the swabs that we receive from various provinces is the most laborious task as well as time-consuming. And so that's what makes the actual test, you know, go for between 24 to 48 hours before the results return back. So in order for us to improve that time between receiving the samples and the results going back to the patient as well as to the National Operations Center, we need that extraction machine as soon as we can get it. Because, you know, when you're waiting for your results, and if you're positive and you don't show any symptoms and you're still walking around, then you might be transmitting the virus to others as well.
Dr. William Pomat, Director of Papua New Guinea's Institute of Medical Research, not exactly full of confidence, is he? And understandably so. COVID-19 has claimed another life in Guam, I can tell you, taking the number of deaths in the US territory to 31. The latest victim is a 77-year-old woman who we're told had underlying health conditions. The total number of coronavirus cases in Guam has risen to 2,045, with 32 more added to the list in the latest batch of 402 tests.
And now, human rights lawyer Veronica Koman remains in exile after incurring the wrath of Indonesian authorities over her campaigning of the freedom fighters in West Papua. But apparently, at least now, she doesn't owe the government any money.
Well, that would appear to be the case. The Jakarta administration certainly tried to put the squeeze on Veronica Komen to pay back the cost of her master's degree gained here in Australia because she failed to go back to Indonesia after completing her studies, which, of course, as a wanted woman in that country, she was never going to do. But she has one less concern to worry about now because the people she's been fighting for, the West Papuans, have stepped in to help by raising more than $50,000, a sum which I strongly suspect will more than wipe her debt back in Indonesia. And Ms. Komen says the money has already been deposited.
It means that my education is not paid by the Indonesian state. It is being paid by the West Papuan people, and it encouraged me more that to be dedicating myself to the cause of West Papua. And because I am still forced into exile, it means that I'll be focusing my work on international advocacy, which is actually the nightmare of the Indonesian government on international diplomacy thing. But what else can I do? Because I cannot appear in Indonesian court, so I'll be focusing my energy on international advocacy.
Indonesian lawyer in exile, Veronica Komen there. And just in time to mention some news of the finalists in Australia's most famous Archibald Prize for Portraiture that will be of particular interest to our followers in PNG, the PNG-born singer Nairi.
Yeah, Nairi, well, she hasn't turned to painting, at least not that I know of, and she certainly hasn't entered the competition, but her portrait is in the list of some 50 or so finalists, from which the winner will be chosen next Friday, September the 25th, I believe. Also, there's a portrait of the Kiwi singer Stan Walker. The artist in question, as far as the Nairi portrait is concerned, is Nick Stathopoulos. He says, "I often paint large works, but in this instance, Nairi's unassuming character dictated a more modest scale. Somehow, a larger-than-life portrait was inappropriate," he says, "despite her flamboyant and glamorous onstage persona, and I sought to capture these opposing qualities." So he's achieved success so far and making it into the final list of around 50 or so, as I mentioned. We'll find out if Nick is the winner this time next week. And you can check out the portrait of Nairi and all the other finalists if you visit the Art Gallery New South Wales website.
Yeah, those pictures are always absolutely beautiful. Richard, thank you so much for bringing us that news.
Pleasure.
Hi, I'm Matt from Pacific Playtime. Pacific Playtime is a show for kids and their grown-ups on ABC Radio Australia. It's all about listening, learning, and having fun. We'll learn new things and discover the world around us.
Oh, the tallest bird in Australia is walking towards me. Do you know what it is? It's an emu. And I'm pretty sure that it's that emu that's making that bumping sound.
We'll even learn some new words.
The word I want to teach you today is nagula. Can you say nagula? Nagula. Nagula means salt water, of the ocean or sea.
Pacific Playtime is all about listening, learning and having fun. Join me each Saturday morning at 7:30 and Sunday morning at 5:30 PNG time, starting September 19th, only on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. The push for a Pacific Islands team to join a revamped Super Rugby Aotearoa competition next year is gaining momentum. With the deadline for bids to New Zealand Rugby coming at the end of business today, it's expected three Pacific bids will be lodged, one from the Fiji Rugby Union, one from the Samoa Rugby Union, and a combined bid from New Zealand-based Moana Pacifica and Fiji-based Pacifica Rugby. The chairman of that group is Colden Kamea, who has previously served on the board of the Fiji Rugby Union and actually introduced rugby league to Fiji in the early 1990s. Now, he and Tony Akoi, whose family have business interests in Fiji, Samoa and PNG, have teamed up with investors in New Zealand to put their part of the bid together in the hope that a Pacific Rugby Union team can join New Zealand's new-look Super Rugby competition in 2021. Richard Hewitt has been speaking to Colden Kamea, who says he is working with Sir Brian Williams, patron of the Moana Pacifica Group, to launch what will be a joint bid for two separate franchises.
The COVID-19 caveat on all this for 2021 is the New Zealand Rugby Union looking at probably only one other franchise, and they have to be based in New Zealand and play the entirety of the season in New Zealand. If that happens, we're happy for Moana Pacifica to pick that up, and we will bide our time until 2022 when possibly it'll expand out, allowing us into the Super Rugby competition from Fiji.
So, in essence, best case scenario at this stage, you're looking to be penciled in, if you like, for 2 years' time.
Absolutely.
Speaking to Sir Brian the other day about the Moana Pacifica bid, I asked him if that team would play outside New Zealand. Would it go to Fiji? Would it go to Samoa? And he said that it would. Now, clearly, in the first instance, it can't, but he's looking at to the future. So is it possible for the two teams to coexist, therefore, if that happens?
Yes, absolutely. Our initial bid has been about the franchise based here in Fiji, involving Fiji, Samoa and Tonga. This is where we live. This is where we play rugby. We want a franchise that is in the Pacific, run by Pacific people and for the Pacific. And so, yes, absolutely, we would welcome any teams coming up this way to play us in future.
So do you envisage perhaps Moana Pacifica being made up of Islander players from the diaspora and your team being made up from players from the islands, from Fiji, from Tonga and Samoa?
That's the plan. Over time, initially 2021, we have to be in the bidding process for 2021. And we're very serious about that. Hopefully we get it. Otherwise, Moana Pacifica get it. But at the end of the day, we will draw our players from the Pacific Islands. And within 2 or 3 years, we hope to be exclusively based on players from Samoa, Fiji and Tonga to stop the leakage out into the rest of the world with these young talent coming through. So we want to keep them here. We want to nurture and develop them, and in time there'll be better young men and better rugby players and available to go anywhere else to make their money. We make no bones about the fact that our franchise, just because of the smaller economies that we have here in our part of the world, we won't be able to match the bigger salaries of the richer clubs around the world. But we can give our guys a sound grounding, very good money for this part of the world, and make them happy. And we hope that that'll all pay off so that they're, as I say, better young men heading out into the rest of the rugby world to make their riches.
Now, there were suggestions that Sir Brian Williams' bid, Moana Pacifica, had support from the three Pacific Island unions, and certainly Simon Raiwaluhi in Fiji raised a few eyebrows when he said it was news to him. So where do you stand on that? Do you have the support of the Fijian Rugby Union and Samoa and Tonga too?
We have a letter from the Fiji Rugby Union, which we are submitting with our bid. They support us in general and conditionally, as they also have a bid. So Fiji Rugby Union has a standalone Fiji-only team bid, as do Samoa Rugby Union. And so we have a letter from Fiji Rugby Union conditionally supporting us. If their bid is knocked over and if we're successful, they will come on board and help us. We've had very good progressive talks with them over a couple of months now, and we're very confident and we'll be able to work together. We can't survive without them. That's the truth, and that's what we've told them. And we look forward to working with them to make this a reality. Tonga Rugby Union is in a bit of a state of flux at the moment. They're in court. Two factions fighting over control of Tonga rugby. So until that's settled, we really can't speak for them.
So just to clarify, there are actually four bids going in. Moana Pacifica, your bid, one from the FRU, one from the Samoan Rugby Union. Isn't that a dangerous way of going about it? This could be divide and rule, couldn't it?
No. On a positive side, it shows the passion for the game. Passion for the game and the fact that this is long overdue. Rugby Union went professional 25 years ago when Super Rugby started, and Australia and New Zealand left us in a lurch. We were Fiji, that is, in the quarterfinals of the Rugby World Cup in 87. Samoa did in 91 and 95. And so between us, we're in the top 8 teams in the world. But when Rugby Union went professional, nobody cared about us, left us out of the loop. And so it's been a long time waiting, Richard, long overdue.
Your franchise, very clearly, it will draw on the three leading unions in the region at this time. But is there a chance that other islands could get a look in down the track?
Yes, absolutely. We have a letter also from Oceania Rugby, 14 members they represent, including New Zealand and Australia. And it's a letter of commendation. They do commend our bid. And I think we're the only one that has their support for now. And with the other nations, we've actually already identified a young man from Papua New Guinea who attends boarding school in Fiji and who's an outstanding rugby player. And we'd like to hope that there's certainly some good talent out there in the other islands, the French territories that end up going through and playing in France. So we'd like to think that we're closer to home and it'll be a lot easier for them to be playing their rugby here.
You personally, you have something of a track record in achieving the unachievable. You did it with rugby league in Fiji. Now you're working working on getting at last the islands to the top of the pyramid, as it were, in rugby union. I mean, you must be pretty excited about this, but maybe quietly excited.
I am, Richard, I am. That's what drove it all in 1992 with rugby league here, because I was heavily involved with the rugby union at the time and the players were getting nothing. Noah Nondruku is an absolutely shining standout example of that, from being a village boy here in Fiji playing rugby, and he ended up with the Canberra Raiders, and you know, the rest is history there. He's a very successful man today. And that's what it's all about for me, is to just help our guys get a fair share of the cake out there, and I hope we can do it this time, because if we don't, it certainly won't happen in my lifetime.
That's Colden Kamea, chair of the Pacifica Rugby bid to join the New Zealand Rugby Super Rugby competition. If not next year, then in 2022. The bidding process closes in Auckland today, and a decision is expected by the end of the month. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, coming up shortly, you're going to hear about the Nikauya Festival, a massive cultural festival in Vanuatu that has brought thousands of people, some from the most remote parts of the country, together. But first, let's have some more music. This is Kira Puru with Say Something.
I couldn't care less if you don't want me, but I'll just say so. I couldn't care less if you don't want me no more. I couldn't care less if you found somebody and that somebody ain't me. I couldn't care less but just loosen my leash and say something, anything at all, or just let me know. Say something, keep me close, or let me go, let me go. Just say something, no, 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 no.
That's Kira Puru with Say Something.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Coronavirus might have put a stop to festivals, events and celebrations in many parts of the world, but on the island of Tanna in Vanuatu, a massive cultural festival has brought together thousands of people from some of its most remote villages and Duran tourists, but local ones given the country's closed borders. The Nikauya Festival has been described as a peace-building exercise, a chiefly ordination and an opportunity for families to arrange marriages. But no matter the meaning, the marathon dance event is a great source of pride for many people on Tanna, as reporter Priyanka Srinivasan found out.
Since the beginning of the year, Jimmy Kauyel and the other men from his village have been hard at work. They've been practicing the toka, a traditional dance from the island of Tanna.
It's 5 months, February, yes. Long time.
The dance involves men hitting sticks together to form a beat. They wear garlands of leaves around their forearms and wrap brightly coloured cloth and feathers around their waists and foreheads. As they jump from side to side to the rhythm, billows of dust erupt from under their feet. Mr. Kauyel says the dance is complex and difficult to learn. But finally, after months of rehearsals behind them, it was showtime. The Nikauya performance had begun.
It is important because it brings tribes and people together to strengthen the ties.
The Nikauya festival is unique to the island of Tanna. It's believed to date back centuries, though no one knows exactly when it started or how many Nikauya have been held since then. Custom and history is passed down through word of mouth on the island, so there's no written documentation of the festival when it began. Preparations and timings for the event are also shrouded in ancient custom. The last Nikauya was 8 years ago in 2012, and Peter Kerr, who manages a local resort, says he found out about this year's event less than a week before it happened.
There's a little bit of anxiety created because of the length of time it took for them to arrive at the toka dates. We're only advised of those dates probably 5 days out, because there was all sorts of rumours circulating. Oh, it's going to be this date and this date. But we took it nothing officially until we heard basically from the horse's mouth.
And once word got out, people flocked from other parts of Vanuatu to see the festival.
It was the first time we'd been busy for quite a few months.
The logistical hurdles mean that very few tourists visit Neko Yar, particularly during the coronavirus pandemic. But for its participants from more than 50 different villages on Tana, the event is unmissable.
The Neko Yar ceremony is the mother of every other event that happens on Tana. It empowers our culture and our traditions.
Tradition.
That's Jean-Pascal Guahe from the Cultural Centre on Tana. He says the Neko Yar was first created to establish peace amongst the warring clans.
Earlier, the tribes used to fight each other. They used to argue over who has the authority. All the different tribes came together to find a solution to stop all these disputes. They decided to host a Neko Yar to bring peace back to their people and to find out who is the paramount chief.
And that significance still holds today. Jimmy Kao Yell's village had been in dispute with the people of Lufna over a parcel of land. But when Lufna village became the hosts of the Neko Yar this year, they invited Mr. Kao Yell's tribe as well. That allowed the two communities to overcome their disagreement.
Tribe that hosts the Neko Yar ask us to be part, so we're part of the Neko Yar. That's why we take part in talk. So it's more like we're strengthening back our relationship through Neko Yar.
But the celebration has another meaning too. The event also serves as an ordination ceremony for chiefs on the island. At the end of the three-day festival, a large totem pole covered in chicken feathers in arrays of colours is raised by one man. He's the Yeremwanu, or paramount chief of the village. Jean-Pascal Wahe from the local cultural centre says the event allows the other tribes to acknowledge and pay their respects to the leader.
The Neko Yar shows everyone that this is the guy who is the chief. He's the one who wears the long feather of the bird that comes out in the early morning.
But the women of Tana have an important role too. They open the festival, performing a dance called the Napin Napin, where they sing and pound their hands on weaved bags for hours on end, all through the night. Priscilla Noel is from White Sands on Tana. She performed the Napin Napin when her community hosted the Neko Yar back in 2003.
The women weave baskets using pandanus leaves, then they fill them with green leaves, and it's those ones that they smack together to make a noise during the Napin Napin. The men join in sometimes as well, but they don't use the leaves, they just dance.
And she says there's a third significance to the Neko Yar. It's a time where men and women from different villages are able to meet and spend some time together, no strings attached.
If they're dancing and a boy or a girl trespasses into the dance and grabs a hold of them, then they can take the dancer for themselves. The customary dance means that everything's allowed. And if a boy likes a girl and he wants to bring her home, he doesn't have to pay for her bride price, like we usually do on Tana. If he finds her during Neko Yar, then it's free.
But Jean-Pascal Wahe from the Cultural Centre says that interpretation of Neko Yar isn't quite accurate.
No, it's not true. It's really about any bad thing that you do. Either you commit adultery or anything else, the Neko Yar washes that away. It's a time for forgiveness and reconciliation, but it's not a time where you simply do something bad because it's Neko Yar.
But one thing is certain, Neko Yar holds a special significance to the people of Tana, and while it now has more modern twists, from colourful tinsel used by the women to photos and videos being shared almost instantaneously to social media, Jimmy Kao Yell says by taking part, he is able to ensure his culture is preserved for generations to come.
For us as Ghana people, it's our identity.
That's Jimmy Kao Yell from Tana in Vanuatu, ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan.
ABC Radio Australia. Join Andrew West for the Religion and Ethics Report.
A survey of more than 1,000 Australians has found that almost 80% of you believe respect for a person's religious beliefs is important in a multicultural society.
What we found overall is that Australians have a relatively positive attitude towards religion.
They think that religion should be respected in a multicultural society. But where we found the key tension was that Australians seem to be viewing religious individuals and religious organisations separately. So they're happy for religious people to say their religious beliefs in public, even when they're offensive, but they're unsure about religious organisations hiring according to their faith. And that is the key tension that we found.
The Religion and Ethics Report, Wednesday evening, 5:30 PNG time, and Thursday afternoon after Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That is all for the program this morning, but don't forget that Talia Olatia will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Stay with us, though, on ABC Radio Australia to keep across all the latest news and developments, and also jump over to our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page where we keep you updated with breaking news and you can get in on the discussion about the different stories that you've heard this morning. My name's Jordan Fennell. Thanks so much for your company today and have a wonderful Friday.